Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome back to The Prospect Interview, where we speak to the brightest minds and talk about the ideas that matter in politics, arts and society. I'm Tom Clark, the editor of Prospect magazine, and this week we're joined by none other than Ed Miliband to discuss, and I only half jest, how to fix the world. The former Labour leader's new book stampedes headfirst into all the great issues of our time, from taming big tech to rescuing the climate and ending the democratic disconnect. And of course, we'll also take the chance to take his mind on affairs of land and sea, as well as Westminster, where he's back on the front bench as shadow business secretary. Ed, thanks for joining us today, and how are you doing?
Well, I'm fine, and thank you so much for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
And so I think probably best to start with the book and to give a couple of examples of what it's about to give people a flavour. Now, one going big idea is very much the Green New Deal, but I thought we wouldn't dwell on that because you've been on the podcast before and writing in Prospect about that before. But I was going to take one example from far away and one from closer to home. So first of all, your ideas about how to fix the rental sector, where you zone in on Vienna, whose housing market I confess I knew nothing about before.
Well, it's interesting this, isn't it? Because the whole issue of affordable housing has been a sort of long-term problem now in Britain for decades. And it's I think when you think about the list of policy failures, I would say it's of governments of both parties, I'd say it's pretty near the top of the list. And what's so fascinating about Vienna is they build social housing. It started in the interwar period, so-called Red Vienna, and they've carried on doing it. And so as a capital city, it's somewhere people can live, whether they're rich or poor, in an affordable way. And, you know, I was part of this Shelter Social Housing Commission a couple of years back with Jim O'Neill, former Conservative minister, and Saeed Avasi, former chair of the Conservative Party. And we all agreed that governments had tried lots of different things to try and fix the housing market. But the thing they hadn't tried for decades was actually to build social housing at scale. And I don't believe that any government is going to get close to the kind of housing supply we need, or stabilising our housing market, or making it affordable for people without building social housing in a big way. And that's one of the recommendations, one of the ideas in the book.
And you don't think you could get there by just, you know, I'm thinking if I was Mr. Barrett, I might want to just come in and get rid of the Green Belt or something as a different way to get housing built. Would that not do the job? Do you think it has to be social?
Well, I mean, quite apart from the environmental problems of that, I mean, that hasn't been the experience. I mean, governments have tried everything they can think of, quotas on affordable housing, but it has tended not to be affordable. There's a dysfunctionality to just leaving this to the market. The market is never going to deliver affordable housing at the scale that is required. And the various interventions that are tried by government tend to be deeply imperfect. And also then you have a whole issue about developers, even with land with planning permission, hoarding the land because they want house prices to go up. You know, they've got an interest in house prices going up. I think it is a classic example of a place where markets on their own just can't fix the problem that we face. And I'd say that both theoretically, but also on the basis of experience. And the other thing that was so interesting about doing the Social Housing Commission, I think Jim in particular kept saying, look, why do we see this as an expenditure, not an investment? You know, we used to, there's this fascinating fact that of every pound we spent on housing in this country, 80 pence used to go on investing in bricks and mortar and 20% on sort of subsidy. Now the opposite is true. And a lot of that is housing benefit. Now 20p goes on house building, if that. And so, you know, and the point is this, which is you've got to be at the scale of, well, we said in the Shelter Housing Commission, 150,000 social homes, council house and housing association homes a year, not in the sort of, well, 10,000 or indeed less, where governments tend to be at the moment. And by the way, that isn't to say that there aren't issues to do with how much affordable housing we should specify for new developments or, you know, our very deregulated private rental sector. And the problem with this is that the revolution that's taken place is not a home ownership revolution. Home ownership is now actually down to relatively back to where levels it was 3 decades ago. The revolution is a growth of insecure private tenancies. That is what has had to pick up the slack.
One thing I found absolutely fascinating, Ed, was that you say that if you do the costings properly and take into account the rent you'll get back and all the rest of it and the assets you build up, this thing's going to cost, building at that sort of scale is actually going to cost less than or similar to HS2.
Indeed. And you might even say it's even more value for money. Yeah, I mean, it's like we did these calculations and the costs start at sort of 10 billion a year, gross costs. But they drop significantly, and there's different ways of interpreting this, once you take account of the different flowback, whether that is in relation to tax receipts or sort of rental income or benefit expenditure. So there's a whole range of reasons why the net cost is significantly lower than the gross cost. And by the way, you know, that's even before you get to the social impact. You know, I think it's really important to say why this is a massive problem. If you're in the private rental sector in the UK, you have no guarantee from 1 year to the next, sometimes even a sort of few months to the next, that you're going to be in the same home. What does that mean for the instability that families face? It's completely unaffordable to live in many parts of our country unless you're on a very, very high wage. So there are just sort of huge problems. I mean, there's a reason why places like Vienna build social housing. It's not just Vienna, by the way. You know, Singapore has a system where people where they build social housing. There's lots of different places around the world that recognize that, you know, you need a mixed economy here, and we've moved away from that.
And so, I mean, in the spirit of go big, Ed, though, I mean, like, you know, you think about 20 minutes off the journey time to Birmingham versus solving the housing crisis, and you do sort of wonder if we've got our priorities wrong, or do you want to go big on everything at once and do HS2 as well?
Look, I've actually always seen the case for investing in infrastructure, including high-speed rail. I've got particular issues about the way it's being done. There's partly the problems it's causing in my constituency, but also that is it really part of a sort of tackling regional inequality agenda, linking up towns and not just, I mean, it just so happens in South Yorkshire, it essentially bypasses South Yorkshire apart from a sort of non-HS2 bit to Sheffield. So it goes through South Yorkshire, but doesn't actually deliver on it. Look, I think there's a wider issue here, Tom, which is we've got to invest in the future as a country. And we've had 10 years of austerity. I think whether it's housing or transport or the climate crisis and investing in tackling the climate crisis, we have big investments we need to make as a country. And it's the right thing to do.
No, because so if investing is one big theme and you're kind of rejecting the austerity logic that says because we're already quite maxed out, we can't invest in everything at once. So you're going big in that sense. Another big going big theme is around decentralisation of power. And I wondered if you could just tell the listeners a bit about the case study you've got in there. Is it Matthew Brown, the guy in Preston?
Yes.
Tell us what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, this, because part of the book is looking at the ways in which people are making change on the ground. So part of it is about the big ideas that can change the country that we can look to elsewhere. But also the I think part of my argument is outside central government, people are making change happen, social movements, local government and so on. Now, what is Matthew Brown doing in Preston? it's what they call community wealth building, and it's really a sort of wider movement now right across the UK. And the idea is this, which is using the big amounts of money that the public sector spends, not just councils, but universities, the police, the NHS and others, to say it's not just about the lowest cost, cheapest price we can get. It's about how do we build wealth in our communities. And so this is what there was a plan to redevelop Preston a number of years back in the wake of the financial crisis. It collapsed. Matthew Brown was responsible for regeneration. And he said, well, hang on, let's just do it a different way. And he worked with CLES, Centre for Local Economic Strategies, a think tank or do tank. And it's about, you know, actually favouring businesses that pay the living wage, keeping the money in Preston and in Lancashire, encouraging cooperatives. This movement actually began in Cleveland, Ohio, and it's being done in Preston. And it's now we're seeing increasing amounts of this elsewhere. We're seeing people looking at community banks and other things. And I think it is a really exciting idea because I think it takes seriously the way government spends its money and the extent to which it encourages or discourages the spreading of wealth, power and ownership. I think it takes seriously the knock-on costs of paying people poverty wages, for example. It might not score to the council's budget, but it scores to DWP in the payments of tax credits or universal credit and so on. And it takes seriously the idea that local government, you know, has power and can make a difference. And I think this goes to a wider point, really, which I make in the book, which is, and I know this has become a sort of cliche, but I think in a way doing this in reality is not a cliche, which is England is far too centralized. It remains far too centralized, even on the government sort of piecemeal approach of devolving some powers. And, you know, part of we've got to take seriously in a comprehensive way at the spreading of power and resources and devolving power. And, you know, I'm really struck talking to Andy Burnham because he is re-regulating the buses in Greater Manchester. But if Andy Burnham wants to run his own municipal bus company, as they do in other parts of Europe, I mean, in some cases they make it free of charge. I cite an example of Dunkirk where they've made it free and it's been a great success, free bus travel. If he wants to run his own municipal bus company, he can't by law. And that says something, just that small example says something about the way we continue to be run as a country with Westminster hoarding so much power.
So, I mean, there's nice little stories at the individual level. You know, got your friend Pat in Doncaster who takes the initiative and pays the church's bills when there's nowhere else looking after people when there's a flood on. And you can see all this local initiative. But for people from the sort of social democratic tradition, which would include you, Ed, there's always two nagging worries, aren't there, about all this decentralisation, despite the kind of local heroes. The first one is, does it cancel out? If every Preston pound ends up being spent in Preston, does that mean that less is going over the border into Burnley or wherever it might be? And do we worry about getting stuck in a zero-sum game?
So is it just protectionism? You know, I don't think it is. And I think it's true for two reasons. Look, first of all, often it was multinational private companies that this money was going to. And the proceeds, if you like, the spoils are going to their shareholders. So I think this is a redistribution, not from sort of, you know, Pimlico to Preston, but actually from sort of shareholders generally at the top of society to people kind of within an area like Preston. That's the first thing. The second thing is, some people might say, well, you know, is it a sort of unlevel playing field that is being sort of put into place? Well, maybe to some extent that's true because it is looking at social and economic outcomes. But what I would say is that the previous approach was actually an unlevel playing field in the sense of the obvious, all of the bias in the system was to go for the lowest cost option, or what looked like the lowest cost option. I think it's a really important point, this. You know, in the old world, Preston would be making its decision. They'd say, well, let's outsource our school meals, for example, you know, lowest cost, you know, minimum wage workers, etc., etc., etc. Now, that might be okay for Preston, but the wider cost to society, I mean, the direct cost in terms of people being paid the minimum wage, having to rely on the universal credit or tax credits, government having to top it up, that's never taken into account in those calculations. And that's even before you get onto the impact on society of people growing up in poverty, all of the implications that has. And that's even before you get onto the question of the money that is there, the kind of demand question of the money that is in those communities to support local businesses and so on. So I think there is a really important idea here about sort of value, how we measure value, and what actually a kind of fair way of approaching these issues looks like. And to be fair to the coalition government, they did bring in something, I think it was in 2012, called the Social Value Act, which started to sort of nibble away at some of these questions, or at least opened up issues around some of these questions. I think there's further we could go. I think we could be thinking about government procurement centrally, how we use that. You know, it's using public intervention to actually support your social and economic objectives rather than a very, very narrow kind of cost-driven view, which actually turns out to be more costly in the long run.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow! Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
And what do you make of, my colleague Samir did a very friendly review of your book, called it very thought-provoking, but he did sort of say, you know, do we really want the local hospital that's got enough headaches already having to worry about supporting the wider economy? What would you say to that sort of just very pragmatic scepticism?
I think that public institutions, and indeed private institutions, should be accountable to their communities and should be aware of the impact they're having on their communities. And an approach that just simply says, let's privatise, let's outsource, let's just go for the least cost, I don't actually think serves communities well. And I think procurement sounds like the dullest, nerdiest issue. It's kind of the issue that people probably think, Tom, you and I spend sort of hours kind of talking about.
When you were unplugging the phone to stop Gordon Brown ringing you up.
Yeah, that's probably true. But actually, it really does matter. I mean, it really does matter. And, you know, if just to use another sort of nerdy phrase of mine, you know, I use this phrase to some derision when I was Labour leader, pre-distribution, i.e. not just after the fact redistribution through the tax and benefit system to create equity, but before you get to taxes and benefits, what kind of economy are you creating? This is absolutely the central challenge we face. I think I'm right in saying that around 2/3 of children in poverty are in families where their parents are working. Now, you know, what are we going to do about that? Well, if we're saying, well, the way the public sector spends its money is off limits when it comes to tackling those questions, we're never going to tackle that issue. After the fact, redistribution on its own won't be able to do it.
Okay, and then one last potential worry is, you know, the one part of the UK, as you detail, where like there's been really serious devolution now is Scotland, and obviously it's sort of been a disaster for the Labour Party because people have started identifying with Scotland as a country before they identify with the Labour movement or the old kind of class solidarity. Have you worried at all that people might sort of, you know, if Andy Burnham succeeds too much, we could end up instead of with a Labour Manchester in 20 years' time with a Manchester First party running things? And I suppose, does it matter? I mean, maybe that is the future.
I mean, look, I don't really see it that way. I mean, it's one of these things where, and this is what the book is trying to do, is to say, look, lift our eyes from the kind of minutiae or day-to-day nature of British politics and think, what do other countries do? And know, when you know, we are the most centralised country, I think, in Europe. Even France is less centralised, known for its strong central state, is less centralised than us. It isn't a good way to run your democracy. And it destroys, it makes people disillusioned about democracy. I talk about bus services in my book and an experience I had when I was first an MP about somebody saying to me, why don't people vote? The reason people don't vote in local elections is because something as crucial as bus services, you can't actually have much impact because it's not in that, at that point, it wasn't remotely in the hands of local representatives. And so I really don't think, I don't buy that. Secondly, local experimentation, local examples can be incredibly helpful in showing the way. You know, what Andy is doing in relation to housing and housing the homeless, the so-called housing first policy, what Sadiq Khan is trying to do around air pollution, we should be inspired by local examples. I mean, they can show us the way. And you know, there's been this odd conspiracy of left and right in relation to centralization, which is the left has thought this is the only way you achieve social justice and avoid a postcode lottery, when in fact the opposite is true. We have massive postcode lotteries from our centralized system, and the right has thought, oh God, you create hotbeds of socialism. And I think both left and right have been wrong about this. It isn't to say there isn't a really important role for central government and a central state, and where the way the central state works is another issue I try and talk about in the book. But I think, you know, I honestly think we've got, our democracy demands we bring power closer to local people.
So an argument through these different ideas about investment and decentralisation and the rest of it, I think, is that in the end, you know, what we might call primary colours politics is going to be more important and more get more done maybe than the kind of, I don't know, pastel shades politics of the new Labour years. And I think I've seen you say that, you know, you wish you'd been bolder in some ways in 2015, and that Jeremy Corbyn, for all his problems, fared better in 2017 by, you know, rather than talking about tinkering with the student loan formula, you say let's abolish fees so it becomes something that kind of captures the imagination. Okay, and if it is, then when Labour thought kind of even bigger in 2019, I mean, there was very go big ideas like the right to buy on from your private landlord and stuff kicking around in the 2019 manifesto. And I wonder, was the party thinking too big at that point? Can you push this too far?
Well, look, I think in a way, what I hope lots of people won't agree with all the ideas I have in my book, but what I've tried to do is sort of partly learn from experience. And it's important to say about this book, this is not a handbook of electoral strategy. I'm not sure people would take a handbook of electoral strategy from me anyway. But, you know, this is about what does the country need. We've got deep and entrenched inequality in our country, exposed again by the COVID crisis. We've been through the financial crisis, Brexit, and what COVID has tragically illustrated about our country, some of the deep divides. And we've got the climate crisis. We're in the decisive decade on the climate crisis. I don't see, so start from the needs of the country. I don't see how you can look at all that and think, okay, the answer is a bit of tinkering around the edges. And I think you've got to, you know, I just didn't agree with everything New Labour did, but it did try and start from an analysis of where the country was, right? So that's the first thing. Secondly, on the elections point, so I learnt that from 2017, I think 2017 I'd call a sort of turbocharged version of my 2015 manifesto, and I think it sort of moved people more. It had a sense of, as you said, primary colours, and so as a matter of electoral strategy, although that's not the sort of primary purpose of the book, I think you know, thinking those primary colours is important. I think 2019 we were undone by a number of factors. Reputationally, Jeremy's leadership had taken a big knock. Brexit divided our coalition. And we did promise too much to too many people. I mean, it looked like we were going to do everything at once, and people don't buy that. I think that's fair. I think the only other point I would make on this go big question, the central thesis of the book, is actually what really strikes me is the change in the nature of my conservative opponents. So Cameron's argument was Miliband is living in a Marxist universe. He wants to cap energy prices. He wants to go on about inequality. And his argument, particularly in the Remain campaign, him and Osborne, was things are pretty good. Vote Remain, right? The Johnson-May argument is a different argument. I mean, it's really striking, this. Their argument, or Johnson in particular, is there are deep inequalities in our country, or as Theresa May put it, burning injustices. I can fix them. Now, personally, I don't believe he can, and I think his sort of vacuous speech on Levelling Up rather illustrated that. But leave that to one side. I think that should tell the centre-left something about where the political battleground is. The next election is not going to be status quo conservatism versus whatever Labour offers. It's going to be who can deliver the change the country needs. And I think that's where the battleground is going to be. And I think that pushes us to show that the change that we can initiate is substantive and big.
So, I mean, you can point to specific things like, you know, the energy price cap or whatever, where they've sort of pinched it off you. And you've also got the Conservatives at the moment, like, you know, the pandemic has forced them to go big, as it were, hasn't it? Like the furlough scheme, no one had thought of that. And there it is, up and running, and everyone knows that Rishi's paying the wages of an awful lot of people, and maybe they're getting some credit for that. At the moment, as I said at the beginning, you are a Labour front bencher now. I don't think I meet anyone who sees Labour at the moment as projecting an image of going big. If they're aware of a story about Labour at the moment, it's something about, you know, trying to purge, like, various, depending on your point of view, you know, radical or headbanging people out of the party. It doesn't feel like Labour's projecting a big vision of how the country could be different. Or do you think I'm being unfair?
I'd say people should be patient. I mean, look, we're in one phase, and we don't know when we're going to be out of it, of this parliament, which is the appalling circumstances of the pandemic. And I think that has been totally understandably top of mind. It's top of mind for businesses that I speak to every day, and indeed the public. What I know from my conversations with Keir, I mean, he's a nice quote about the book, but what I know from my conversations with him is that he does believe that when it comes to our economy and the economic change we need, tinkering around the edges is not the answer. And that we as a country do need big change. And there is a process of policy development which takes place, and, you know, it happens with oppositions. There is a cycle to these things. So, you know, look, I hope my book is a contribution to the debate within Labour about what's the kind of policy agenda for the future, but also other parties as well. But, you know, I'd say sort of watch this space. And look, the other thing I would just say is this, which is anyone who thinks they know the outcome of the next election, I wouldn't take them very seriously. This, you know, I resigned as Labour leader in 2015. After that, we had, I'm not saying cause and effect, Brexit, Trump, the election of Jeremy Corbyn, you know, the 2017 election, which everybody said Theresa May was going to win with a massive majority, the 2019 election. I mean, politics is the future is very, very unknowable. And I think that actually the fight of the future, the fight of the next election, is going to be the fight about the future. Who can learn the lessons? We've been through this crisis where we've seen an incredible spirit for the British people, but we've seen our institutions way off that spirit. So whether that is the pay of key workers, the underinvestment in our public services, who has power at work and who doesn't, all of those questions I think are now open, and I think we owe it to ourselves and the country to learn the lessons of that. And I think that will be the defining questions of the coming election.
Last thought, though, if you think of the last time Labour was on its way into government in the mid-90s, and I think it's fair to say a slightly control freak operation. I was just trying to think if Tony Blair or indeed Gordon Brown, how they would have felt about a kind of Jack Straw or a Margaret Beckett or a Robin Cook writing a big book with big ideas on housing, transport, and, you know, absolutely everything else. Doesn't it sort of, I don't know, does it not say that Labour feels quite a long way from office, that Keir's relaxed enough to let you publish this and put a nice quote on the back, because he's not terribly worried about people costing this and getting into tax bombshells and all of that.
Well, the truth is that this is not the next, as I say in the foreword to the book, this is not the introduction to the book, this is not the next Labour manifesto. This is a set of ideas arising out of my podcast. No, I think what it says, actually, is that we're in a very different era from the 1990s, not in the sense that you said, but in the sense of, I think people, so much is open, Tom. So much is open about what does the future look like. And, you know, the conservative, I saw, the way I think about this is you had the 1979 to 2008 period, and that was sort of one settlement. And it's like, to use a sort of rather maybe awkward footballing metaphor, we're in sort of injury, we've had kind of 30 years of injury time of the old settlement. And the question is, what does a new settlement look like? And I think that that is what different parties in their different ways are groping or trying to find a route towards. And look, I don't expect all 20 ideas in my book to be the next Labour manifesto. I hope it can help. I'll hopefully take some of them forward in my role as Shadow Business Secretary where they're in my area. But hopefully it can stimulate a debate and thinking in Labour, but also in other parties. You know, Saeed Avasi is on the book saying nice things about it. You know, across the political spectrum in saying, how do we define this new settlement? Because, goodness me, the old settlement isn't working for lots of people in our country. We're in this, as I say, you know, I want to sort of emphasise this point. We have talked about the climate before, but, you know, if there is one overwhelming issue, apart from coronavirus, that we face in this decade, it is the climate crisis, because the actions we take in these few years will have impacts for the next few hundred years. And so it's for different parties to formulate a programme that responds to that moment. And you know, I'm sort of somebody who believes that ideas do matter in politics. I mean, ideas on their own don't win you elections, but without them, you definitely don't win elections. And that's the kind of contribution that I'm trying to make with this book.
Terrific, Ed. Thanks very much for cheering us all up. I should have said at some point, this book, in a sense, is a spin-off of Ed's own podcast with Jeff Lloyd, Reasons to be Cheerful. So look that up, as well as looking up the book. If you want to try before you buy, as it were, you can look up Samir Rahim's review on the Prospect website. But thanks to all of you for listening in at home. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please do leave us a rating and a view, which helps us get more people listening. Goodbye, stay safe, and we'll see you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.